Carolyn showed you that the Earth revolves around the Sun in a swarm of asteroids. The net result of our dozen-year survey in Palomar, that was our major goal, is to estimate the population that's out there. And our best estimate is there are about 1,500 objects larger than a kilometer in diameter. Present time, we think that the global census has been carried out not just by ourselves, but by others, including Duncan Steele and his team right here in Australia, and a number of other teams. We have only found about 10% of this total population, but based on the volume of space that we were searching and the discovery rate, this is based on a total detection of about 90 objects. Our estimate is that they're about 1,500, bigger than a kilometer. It turns out that the numbers drop off steeply as you go to larger sizes. So the very biggest Earth-crossing asteroid known is 9 kilometers in diameter. That's the asteroid known as 1620 Ivar. So actually, that's the reason that comets dominate the upper end of the size scale. Down for comets, for objects about a kilometer across, we think that probably asteroids are a little bit, their collision is a little bit more numerous than comets. But there are lots of comets that are 9 kilometers across and bigger. So they utterly dominate the production of big craters. A comet the size of Halley or Arrakis Algar will make a crater about 150 kilometers across. An object, either a comet or an asteroid about 1 kilometer diameter makes a crater, depending upon its density and velocity, on average, makes a crater in the ballpark of about 12 to 15 kilometers across. Okay, we can add all of this up. Remember that the numbers in there, just repeat the collision probability, the mean collision probability for an individual Earth-crushing asteroid is 4 chances in a billion per year. That's the mean that Carolyn showed you earlier. So if you multiply that by the number of objects that are there, say 1,500 bigger than a kilometer, that means an asteroid bigger than a kilometer hits the Earth 6 times per million years. That starts to get to be an interesting rate geologically. And actually, the rate of production of craters, if we say start at 10 kilometers, that would actually be formed by somewhat smaller asteroids, the rate of cratering is about 1 every 100,000 years. Now, of course, 2/3 of those are formed in the ocean, the crater forms in the water and disappears promptly, since the 1/3 is formed in the continents that's left. So at the big end, however, we get a crater formed, a 150-kilometer crater formed. Our best estimate is that happens on average about once every 100 million years. If you make a 150-kilometer diameter crater, it doesn't matter whether it's the ocean or the continent. The ocean is actually thin skin on that crater. You make a big crater on the ocean floor, so you get it either way. It's a permanent crater. So we can go through the numbers, and this is now based. Actually, this is lifted from a book by my colleague David Rout, who's written some very interesting papers on the topic of the effects of impacts. He's connected these with mass extinctions. And this is from his book, Extinction, Bad Genes or Bad Luck. And he took the numbers that I gave him, and he put a little bit too much in the way of significant figures on here. So don't worry about that. It's just that 10 kilometer craters, the frequency is about once, the time interval, the average time interval between formation about every 100,000 years, a 20 kilometer crater about every 500,000 years, a 31 kilometer crater about a million years, and so on down here. And these are the comet craters. They're dominated by comets. We get solid. Okay, next slide, please. Now, what do we actually see? You know, I wonder, is it possible to get the lights a little darker?
Thank you. Excellent.
Okay, that's good. Let's just stop it. We can't fool Mother Nature. We need a computer. Okay. Well, I hope everybody in this room knows where this is. That's Wolf Creek Crater. Up in the Kimberley District, the political district, not the geological district, of Western Australia. It's the second largest crater on the Earth, now known, that has associated meteorites. The only kind of meteorites are the very young craters, and they're almost in all cases very small craters, and associated meteorites are irons. A couple of exceptions are stony irons. So this is a crater. We've mapped it in detail geologically. We now have an age for it. Our best number is based on the terrestrial age of the meteorite, 310,000 years. It is the oldest crater with associated meteorites. It's about, this is an oblique view, of course, it's about 900 meters in length this way. It is slightly elliptical in plan, at about 850 meters across. And actually, we know the trajectory, too. It came in from this side. And the beds are very deeply upturned here and then flipped over on this rim, whereas they're flipped back very sharply on the upper-range side. And that's a typical pattern by which we can determine the trajectory. Down trajectory over here on the other side of Wolf Creek is where one finds the meteorites and the impact rocks, which Carolyn discovered during our mapping in 1985. So this is a good example of the little guy. By little guy, I mean an asteroid that was only about 50 meters across. Next slide, please. Now, when we go back and look and try to look at very big impact structures, usually they're older. The crater is often long gone, although there are actually a couple of craters getting close to this size range that are still craters on the Earth. One of them is the Lee Space in Germany. Another is a crater way up in the Arctic Islands north of Canada. This is a very nice impact structure. It's the oldest one we know in Australia. This is in Western Australia. I'm sure some people in this audience will recognize it as the Teague Ring. Joe Harms is in the evidence, and he's one of the geologists who first recognized this for what it was, as an impact structure. This is the Logan Block here to the south, Archean terrain. These dark outcropping units actually are covered dark by the iron formation that's in the Frere Formation. It turns out it's only a small part of the Frere, but it really makes the outcrop dark all the way here and down here. And the Frere is dropped down in a ring structural depression here. The whole structure is actually tilted to the north-northeast, as is the edge of the basin. And we have quite, this is the edge of the Namaroon Basin. And we have quite a thick stack of early protozoic rocks in here, the Garahini group. They're actually 4 kilometers, or they drop down the ring structural depression over here, a much thinner sequence. On this side, that's where we see the dark rocks of the Frere coming around. Right in the middle, we find the uplift of the Archean terrain again. This is the central uplift. This is the classical pattern of a large impact structure on the Earth. You can recognize these patterns if the target is already a stratified target and has not been too badly deformed by prior or later tectonic activity. So this one is an easy one to spot. Carolyn found it about 6 times over going through the Landsat images in Western Australia. So if Joe and some of the other people hadn't already gotten there for indeed mapped it first, it would have been an easy one to pick up in a broad continent-wide survey. Another diagnostic feature, which we just started mapping out in detail, is that the sedimentary collar, that turn stratified collar around the Archean here, is puckered in steeply plunging folds and also repeated by rising thrust faults. During the collapse of the original cavity formed by impact, material falls in from all sides with a convergent flow, and then the stratified rocks are puckered just as a napkin would be, serviette pulled up through a ring. Would be puckered, and that's one of the diagnostic structural features. There are shatter cones in these beds and other shock effects as well. This is a feature that's 30 kilometers in diameter. That's just about the size structure, and the original crater probably corresponded pretty closely to the edge of the collapse region, the edge of this main structural depression, which is right on over here on each side. It's just about the size feature that would have been formed. by that asteroid that Carolyn showed you earlier, which is named Ommen, which is the Ommen asteroid. It'll probably generate in the next 10 million years. Make something with a good crater and it'll be forming beds underneath, like this. Next slide, please. Now, there's another very important impact structure in South Australia, which is first recognized by George Williams, who, interestingly enough, worked for the same company as Joe Harms, BHP, and he was working for BHP at the time he first started investigating this feature. He went out there and suspicion, in fact, might find brecciated rocks, which he did. This is the salina known as the as Lake Ackerman. That's right in the middle of the Gawler Craton, in the Gawler Volcanics, as a matter of fact. And these, under the sand dunes in these islands, out here in the center, one actually finds the impact structures preserved with all of the shock effects that we've come to recognize in impact structures. I have a little bit of disagreement with George Menyns on the size of the original crater, because once one gets back out of this terrain here and out here, one finds essentially flat line dacites of middle Proterozoic age. So I think the real crater lay within this topographic basin, was probably no greater than about 40 kilometers in diameter, somewhat bigger than the edge of the salina. Now, this is a very interesting structure on a number of accounts. First of all, it's one of the best dated because the flow-out and the distant fallout of this material is recorded in the stratigraphic sequence, so we can pin it stratigraphically, and that leads to some very interesting things. Next slide. Next. Here's a geologic map of a portion of South Australia. Here's the Spencer Gulf up here. So Adelaide is down here on this off the map. Here's the Gawler Craton. In fact, these are the Gawler Volcanics. Here's Lake Ackerman in the middle of it over here. Now over here was the Adelaide Geosyncline. Now all folded up and trusses somewhat like the Appalachians in the eastern west. It was a 10 kilometer thick stack of sediments being laid down in very late Proterozoic time and into Cambrian time. And near the top of that stack, about 1,100 meters below the Ediacaran fossil horizon, next slide please, Victor Gostin and Adelaide, with his students, discovered this very interesting little red band between some gray bleached rocks in the Flinders Ranges. I think this is very close to one of their discovery localities. He's pointing to it here. It was not immediately understood what it was. In fact, he thought he discovered a volcanic ash horizon. And reasonably enough, because the fragments in there are indeed volcanic rocks. Turns out they're much older than the beds themselves, the original volcanic rocks. Next, please. This is just a close-up, not of that outcrop, the one very nearby, so you see it in the sequence. You can see it's a bed, typically a couple centimeters thick, although it varies from place to place. And the largest fragments have actually been found are about the size of a football. Those are very rare. What came to light after a lot of study was, in fact, there were a lot of shock material in here. There were plenty of deformation lamellae in the quartz phoenicus, in this siliceous volcanic rock, the dacite. There were little tiny shatter cones in there. And so we see a whole range of shock effects that even little melt spherules, but they're fairly rare and hard to find and recrystallize now. And in addition, next slide please. Gostin went in with other colleagues and looked at the distribution of noble metals and other siderophile elements, iron-loving elements. Now this is work that was done in the mid-1980s. And this, of course, I knew what to look for at that time. So here's sampling as one goes up the sequence of beds, starting about 5 meters below that thin bed, measuring the iridium content in parts per billion. And then you hit that little thin bed, bang, there's a nice anomaly, over one part per billion of iridium, then drops back down very close to the background levels. Gold shows the same signature. As this platinum, you'll notice that there's actually about 2.5 times as much platinum as there is iridium, which is a good thing because that's close to the cosmic abundance ratio of platinum to iridium, palladium. So this is just a sequence
of the elements, these elements in particular, which are much higher in meteorites than they are in the crust of the Earth. In fact, the average abundance of iridium in ordinary stony meteorites, chondritic meteorites, is about 10,000 times higher than it is in average continental crustal rocks. The reason for that is fairly well understood. The iridium in the Earth, the original iridium in the Earth, is pretty well extracted quantitatively into the core at the time the core is formed. And so the crust is depleted, but primitive material coming from asteroids, from the meteorites or comets, can be expected to deliver a much higher proportion. So the iridium and the other platinum group metals make a very nice tracer for the impacting body, and that in fact is what you see. This is material that is vaporized or in fact condensed out and came down with a little, blast. Blown out of the crater. Now it would have been very nice if this had all been known in 1980, a few years earlier, because then it would have been obvious what the signature was that was discovered by the Alvarez team at Berkeley at the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary. Of course, it was following the discovery of the Cretaceous Tertiary noble metal anomaly, and so it took the Berkeley team a couple of years scratching their heads to figure out what it really meant. In fact, they went off on a wild goose chase for a while, thinking maybe it was a signature of a nearby supernova. Louis Alvarez rather liked that idea, and the sign was proven by the isotopic composition of the iridium. It couldn't be that. But it was the obvious conclusion. They were looking for an anomaly, or not an anomaly, but just the abundance of iridium that would be produced by the gentle inflow of cosmic dust at the rates we see today, and what they found was much too much to be accounted for that way. And the obvious answer is it came all in one big batch. But it took quite a while to come to that conclusion. Next slide, please. Well, here is the discovery locality for the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary. It's on a road cut to just a little ways out of town from the medieval city of Gubbio in the Apennine Mountains of Italy. It's a famous section geologically and was very thoroughly studied by the Italian micropaleontologists. And these beds here, we're seeing them close up, so that's the edge of the coin, just for scale, that's a centimeter thick clay layer. These beds are deep water marine limestones. They're composed entirely of fossils, mostly of some microscopic platelets of the algae that were growing on the surface of the ocean and sedimented out from the ocean floor, and mixed in with the these platelets are larger fossils, but still mostly microscopic, called the little shells called the zooplankton that were feeding on the algae. There are 20 species recognizable in the zooplankton. They're called foraminifera, that one can find going on down, many tens of meters down the road cut. And there's a steady population. You come to the boundary, you skip over the clay layer. And this is the last of the Cretaceous. This is the beginning of the Tertiary, and they're all gone. Everyone disappeared. In fact, one can recognize about 20 species of the algae. They're called nanoplankton under the electron microscope, and the nanoplankton are all replaced by new species when one crosses the boundary. Now these were subtropical waters. What has happened is that the ones that disappeared actually were replaced in part by species that had to migrate in from higher latitudes. But this is part of the mass extinction. Now actually it turns out there's a little bit missing here, probably by solution, maybe 10 centimeters of depth. That's only at the maximum. It's only a small amount. And there is a little bit of record of the transition in the loss of species in the nanoplankton in particular. Everyone crosses the boundary. It's a very sharp extension and it begins precisely at the clay layer. Next slide, please. The initial analyses weren't carried out to the precision, in other words, that was possible by radiochemical techniques at the time. And the group at Berkeley then went back and built a brand new system to do very rapid, very precise, very sensitive analyses. So now we look at parts per trillion. So this is a later paper by Frank Asaro, who's a radiochemist, in this work, showing very detailed sampling across the boundary, starting here about 1 1/3 meters, or 1.5 meters, below the clay layer, which is right up here, and you can see the background level down here is in the range of about 10 to 15 parts per trillion. That turns out actually to be very close to the average abundance in sedimentary rocks at the surface. There's some interesting bumps, maybe up to about 50 parts per trillion. Then you hit the boundary, and this peak is enormous. It's cleared out of the room over there at 3,000 parts per trillion, so it's way off the scale. Then you drop right back down. There's a tailing off, and there's another interesting bumps for the next meter and a half. Probably due in part to the reworking of the noble metals as they washed off the continents. We think these things are explained just by enhancement of the clay content and the cyclical enhancement of the clay versus the fossil material itself. But these bumps are not explained. It's possible that this is a record of a meteor stream associated with the object that hit the Earth, and the Earth had gone through that meteor stream for 100,000 years or more before there was actually an impact. So that's speculation. We don't really understand these bumps down here. The standard explanation is this is just a really diffusing away from that very rich source in the clay layer. Next slide, please. Now, there was an argument at first that maybe this anomaly is just due to something happening geochemically in the ocean, despite the fact that the abundance ratios of the various noble metals was right bang on pretty much what you expect from the primitive material coming in at either comets or asteroids. But that argument went away when the clay layer was also found in continental sediments. These are extreme deposits. This is in the Raton Basin in New Mexico and Colorado. This site's just above the Colorado border. That's the same anomaly right here in continental sediments. I should tell you that by now, this boundary and the iridium with it has been seen at more than 200 localities around the world. Next slide, please. This is just a slab now, a close-up prepared by my colleague Glenn Izette, who now retired from the Geological Survey. So this is the white clay layer you were looking at. This is actually a slab taken just a few kilometers north of the site you just saw. And it's sandwiched between carbonaceous horizons and carbonaceous clays down here. There's a coal bed actually just above it. These are actually the best preserved sections of the boundary where coal was being deposited at the time. And so that all the details are preserved. It turns out there are actually two layers. There's this lower layer, typically a couple centimeters thick, and then there's an upper layer. It's a little bit disturbed here because even though it's taken from the wrong cut, there's been weathering. This yellow stuff is iron sulfate. It's the mineral of jarosite, and that's just due to oxidation of some sulfide minerals that were in this layer of winter. But it messes it up a little bit. This gray stuff in between is thinly laminated clay stone, and that's where you see the big iridium peak. Now we're going back to parts per billion here. 10 parts per billion, rather common number for the peak of iridium at the boundary. And it's clearly up here, not in the main white clay layer, but in the thinly laminated layer above. And this is also the horizon where one finds completely independent evidence of a big impact. This is in the form of shock, quartz rings. It still holds a mystery as to why we have two layers. But this is quite clearly the main fallout layer here. And this is something that is then very gradually come down out of the atmosphere at a later time. And why it has a course of quartz grains in it is still an unexplained mystery in these continental sites. You can see that iridium is a little bit mobile and diffuses out of this source, gets concentrated in the coal. A particular coal is a good getter for iridium, and in these carbonaceous layers below when there's some concentration down there. Next slide, please. Now here's where the quartz grains out of the boundary. They are abundant in the Rocky Mountain region of North America. They're not difficult to find. All you have to do is sand that slab and you can feel the quartz grains sticking out. This is a typical quartz showing the planar deformation of the metal. They are formed precisely on preferred crystallographic directions. And we know are produced, or the lamellae produced by shock in known impact sites and by shock in the laboratory. What's actually happening here is in a very, very thin layer of glass, usually some microscopic, along each one of these. And now, in the common, there are half a dozen different crystallographic directions, so as you rotate the layer on a spindle, you bring it into view under the microscope. This is a sand grain size. It's about 100 microns across. Next slide, please. Welcome back. Now here's a plot by Ben Isaac based on his work and that of Bruce Bulldor, who's also now retired from the Geological Survey. Oh, let's work on this and all not often retired. Who was the one who first discovered the shock quartz veins? And it's a somewhat simplified distribution. There are actually dozens of localities where the shock quartz is now known. And the size of the dots here show the maximum size of the quartz grains discovered at various sites up here in the Rocky Mountain region, down near Mexico, and down here, this is the a very special site on Haiti. And if you go elsewhere in the world, over in Europe, North Africa, New Zealand, of course this is a map of the world at the end of the Cretaceous, for those who are not geologists in the audience, so that's where it looks so funny, that's where the continents were at that time. There are also sites in deep sea cores out in the Pacific and also in the Atlantic, where they have been observed, and you can see that the size of the dots is proportional to the size of the veins. The largest quartz veins are in this region. Now originally Alvarez had hoped that if we had lots of samples from around the world, you'd see some kind of a bullseye pattern in the meridian. Not so. It turns out the world is just pretty, within the vagaries of deposition, is essentially uniformly distributed around the world. It's the shock quartz grains that gave us the pattern. In fact, it's not just the size of the grains. In this region here, the shock quartz is about two orders of magnitude more abundant, typically, at the boundary layer than it is in these more distant regions. So that was telling us that we ought to look for the crater somewhere in the neighborhood of North America. Not only that, the grains were quartz, and there were also minor granitoid grains of shock tacit plane sparse present as well. It was telling us the crater was formed at least in part on continental crust. So that was open. Since two-thirds of the world's crust was ocean floor, and half of that at the end of the Cretaceous has been subducted, there's a chance the whole crater might have disappeared. But if it was on a continent, it might be preserved. Next slide. Well, here's again a paleospastic map reconstructing of where things were at the end of the Cretaceous, 65 million years ago, of the critical region. And it turned out there was another key piece of evidence. As one looked at exposures of marine sediments here in southern United States and going around in the northern Mexico, there were very peculiar deposits right at the boundary, which were telling us that we were getting close. Also, I want you to see where the island of Haiti was 65 million years ago. Those of you not familiar with the Caribbean may not know that it's now out here beyond Cuba, but it was back here, fairly close to what's part of Mexico at the present time. And you can see where the final crater was finally located here on the northern tip of Yucatan by the tiny, it's named for a drill hole by a tiny village called Chicxulub. Actually, it's a pretty big city called Merida that's within the crater, but the name is taken from the drill site. Well, starting up here and looking at shallow water marine deposits, team in the United States, next slide please, headed by Jerry Bourgeois, who's a specialist on tsunamis and tsunami deposits, and Earl Kaufman, a paleontologist, and some others, went down to the Brazos River in Texas, and here's what they found in the boundary. As you go down into the Cretaceous, it's a long sequence of very fine grained sediments laid down in fairly quiet water. Then you come to the boundary there are rocks that are made up of fragments of glass that have been ripped up from the lower material, and a rather interesting sequence with some climbing ripple beds and so on, but coarser material overall, and then it settles down finally and you go back into quiet water deposition. This is just three different sections along the Brazos River, not very far apart, as you can see up here. The iridium anomaly actually is localized close to the top of the sequence, and they said, aha, what we're looking at here is a tsunami, or more exactly, probably several waves, several tsunamis coming in successively, which have disturbed the sediments and laid down this very unusual The biggest of these rip-up class are again about the size of a football. This same pattern can be traced down into Mexico, where the tsunami sequence gets even thicker and better defined. And so that's telling us we're headed toward the crater. Next slide, please. Here's what it actually looks like. It's in gravity. The entire crater is covered with an average thickness of limestone, a tertiary limestone of about a kilometer. So you can't see the crater at the surface, but you can see it very nicely with geophysical profiling and seismic reflection profiling, most of which is still company confidential. But this is a region of Mexico where the giant oil fields have been developed in Mexico. So it's been intensively explored by Pemex, which is the national petroleum company in Mexico. And this is an early version, actually, of the gravity anomaly. For the geologists, that's a big-way gravity anomaly we're looking at. And the edge of the crater is pretty much out here. There's some debate about whether there's a farther disturbance. I think that there is. But if you've been there the day after, the real rim of the crater, I think, would have been over this feature. It's a multi-ring structure, as you can see here. And this high in the middle is over the central upper. The crater has actually been explored by about a half a dozen drill holes, which penetrated shock melded and shock metamorphosed material, which can be dated. There was some debate about the age, but I think it's very clear it is a crater formed right at the end of the Cretaceous. In fact, some surprisingly good dates were obtained from the shock melt at 65 million years. There's a peculiarity on the north side. We're not sure what that means yet. Peter Schultz suggested this is an oblique impact, and the trajectory was from this direction, and that's why you see a quite different pattern going out here to the northwest. Next slide, please. It's 180 kilometers in diameter. I didn't say that. A little bit bigger than the size crater we'd expect if Halley were to hit the Earth, or Eyelash or Rafi Alcott. Just about the right size crater for another infamous periodic comet, which I won't mention that, about 15 kilometers across, and which is coming very close to the Earth on repeated passages. Now, over in the island of Haiti, the clay layer is no longer just a couple centimeters thick, it's several tens of centimeters thick, and it has spherules in it. Actually, we see spherules all over around the world. Usually they're replaced, almost everywhere they're replaced by secondary minerals, but here in Haiti, the spherules get bigger, some of them up to a centimeter across, and then again, they're mostly replaced by later clay minerals, but you break them open. Here's the spherule, this is a few millimeters across here, break them open, and inside is glass. The original impact glass is still preserved. Next slide, please. Come back. Here are just some of these residual glass cores bent out of the spheres by Glenn Isett from a slab that was brought back to him from Haiti. These are tektites, beautiful tektites. One can date the tektites there, of course, right at 65 million years too. Their dates match exactly the impact melt in the crater. You can also compare the chemical and isotopic composition with glass. It's quite variable. Part of the target rocks were limestones. There was a half kilometer thick section around hydrite, that's calcium sulfate. And one sees variable contents of calcium and surprisingly sulfur in these tektites. You very rarely see sulfur, it's too volatile. An element normally you found a tektite, but present in some of these glasses. So there's a chemical fingerprint that ties these glasses to the crater. Moreover, one can look at the isotopic composition of the glass and match that to the crustal materials at the crater. So we're very confident. The age right, the provenance is right. This is glass that came from the Chicxulub crater. Since the sites in Haiti were found, glass has been found at a number of sites in Mexico as well. So that's very fortunate indeed. Next slide, please. Okay, well, I've given you a thumbnail sketch of the evidence for impact at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. And now let's have a look and review whether this applies to other events in geologic history. This is now one of the rather famous diagrams by the team of Jack Sapkowski and David Ralph at the University of Chicago. This is a later plot, not their first one, based on Sapkowski's enormous catalog of the time distribution
of genera of marine organisms, fossil organisms, for the last 250 million years. He actually cataloged those all the way back to about 500 million years ago, but this is the part of interest at the moment. And this simply shows the rate of fractional extinction of genera that can be seen in one stage. These little teeny tiny boxes, you can't read it all down here, are a series of units, stratigraphic units, or tiny stratigraphic units called stages, that are variable length and average about 6 million years. And one just says what animals were there in the earlier stage that disappeared in the next stage. And then Sapkowski applied on top of this a rate, has actually used the length of the stage, estimated length of the stage, to get an actual rate of disappearance. I wouldn't really portray the data that way, but it's good enough for our present purposes. Here is the extinction peak that we've just been talking about. Actually, if one looks at the total loss of species between the last stage of the Cretaceous and the first stage of the Tertiary, it's about 70% loss of species. So it was a major extinction. And it makes a peak like this on this diagram. There are other peaks of various heights. There's a really bigger of a peak back here at the end of the Triassic period, which is probably an even stronger extinction. And the granddaddy of all extinctions is the one at or near the end of the Permian, in which 95% of the species disappeared. That may be a multiple extinction event extending over some period of time. There are other lesser peaks, and it becomes a problem of when is it mass extinction to mass extinction? Probably we could pick these, and that may be the smallest peak we want to call a mass extinction. One at the end of the Middle Miocene, about 11 million years ago. There's a good one here, so we'll look at the details. At 35 million years ago, in the late Eocene, there's another one here at the Cenomanian-Turonian boundary, 92 million years ago, and so there's one here. There's one at the end of the Jurassic. I don't believe any of those. I think that's just background extinction, basically. This really good one here and here. Let's see how many of these peaks might have evidence for impact. Next slide, please. This is just a progress report. I have to remind you. I mean, as one goes along, one learns more and more. Here is a record of iridium from a deep sea core south of Australia, which was sampled by Frank Asaro at Berkeley using their brand new specially designed gamma ray spectrometer. What you do, you have to irradiate the sample in a nuclear pile with neutrons. You activate the sample and then you scan it for activity at the frequency associated with the radioactive species of iridium made by neutrons. And you can scan it with a quick scan first, just to see if there's anything interesting, and then if you see something interesting, you can go back and make a long count and get a very much higher precision result. And that's what we see here. So these are the quick scans, that's just background through here, and then they saw a peak, so they went back and re-scanned, and you can see again the background abundance of iridium in this deep sea core is about 10 to 15 parts per trillion, and then there's a very nice peak over here going up to about 150 parts per trillion. So it's a factor of 10 enhancement over the background. You might ask, well, how often do you see these things? And the answer is very seldom. There have been thousands and thousands of analyses done looking for these things, and these are the rare events. Actually, Asaro studied another core about 6,000 kilometers away in the Southern Ocean, and has found a peak at the same place in the stratigraphic column. This is at the end of the Middle Miocene. So it does seem as though we have circumstantial evidence there was an impact event, probably a pretty good one. Not as big an event as recorded at the Cretaceous Tertiary boundary 65 million years ago, but nevertheless there's pretty good circumstantial evidence for an impact at about the right time for the extinction. Next slide, please. Other things that you can look for, of course, are impact glasses. These are various kinds of glasses. The ones that have no crystals in them are called microtectites. And these, in fact, are the North American microtectites. They're 35 million years old. Beautiful little jewels. These are sand-sized grains. This is microscopic view. They occur very abundantly in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of North America and the Atlantic. And for years, we wondered where they came from. We actually know where the impact crater is now. It's at the southern end of Chesapeake Bay. Again, it's a buried crater, and is now well explored with seismic reflection profiles, and people are just getting into to the drilling on that, but the edges of the crater, the shallower parts, are very well known from a lot of water wells. And again, it's a pretty good sized crater. So this is another kind of evidence for impact. And this is at the time of the distributed mass extinction in the late Eocene. Next slide, please. Now this is just for the paleontologists and the stratigraphers in the audience. This is a deep sea core in the Pacific, in which the distribution of forelands through the core is plotted. And you can't quite read all of this, don't worry about focusing. This is middle Eocene here, late Eocene, and this is Oligocene. 35 million years comes in right about here, and this time period right through here is about a million years long. If one plots the distribution of these little critters that were feeding on the algae in the surface of the ocean, these are the plankton or animalcula, one can see that across the time interval, it's an order of 1 or 2 million years in here, the entire recognizable species of forams is replaced by new ones. And the old ones seem to go out in a series of discrete steps. You can pick out maybe four of them in here. So it's what we call a stepped mass extinction. It's a complete turnover in these species during that time. And indeed, there is a turnover in the other fossils as well at this time. But our best record is really for these microscopic bugs in the ocean. Now, right in this time period is where we see the evidences of impact. In fact, here's the horizon of the North American micropeptides. That's localized to an area near North America. Right below it, about 30 centimeters below in the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico, there's a second layer of impact spherules. This time they carry crystals that have been called microcrystites. You can trace this layer all the way across the Pacific Ocean. And a third layer comes in right at this horizon, this step in the mass extinction, which is seen in the Western Pacific. In fact, you can see three horizons in one core in the Western Pacific. In fact, around the world, we see, in fact, there are mild iridium anomalies with these two horizons. But this is all in such a short period of time, it's hard to tell how to tell exactly how to correlate all the iridium anomalies. We see iridium anomalies, shock quartz, little spherules in many localities. We see them in Europe. They're seen in deep sea cores down in southern waters. We're not sure exactly how many events are represented. At least three, maybe more. And they coincide with extinctions. This event actually coincides with a pretty good extinction in another little beastie called the Radiolarian. This is a significant extension of Radiolaria at the time of this event. Well, I think this close space sequence of impacts is probably our best record of what we call a comet shower, the period of time when there's actually a pulse of comets hitting the Earth, and we expect a typical comet shower to have a mean lifetime of about a million years. That is, it decays away by a factor of E, a factor of about 3, in about a million years. This is just about the right time range for these events. So we have a distributed mass extinction and multiple impacts in a condensed interval of time. And there's very clear evidence of the stratigraphic correlation now of these two classes of events. Interestingly, as each one of these species went out, it was the warmer water species that were disappearing, and they were generally replaced by cooler water species, finally ending up at the end of the Eocene with a cold ocean. That was the time in which there was a continental ice cap developed over Antarctica, and the entire ocean went cold at that time. I find it very intriguing that we see the stepwise cooling. In fact, you can document this with oxygen isotope measurements, the stepwise cooling of the ocean through this period of time, finally ending up with the continental ice cap on Antarctica, and it's at the time of this burst of fairly substantial impacts. Probably one of the other really big impact craters we know about, which is in northern Siberia, called the Papagai crater. It's a 100-kilometer crater, was formed in this time range, as well as the crater that was the source of the North American microtectites. Next slide, please. Okay, now if we jump back 92 million years, we'll go to the next peak. We're working our way back in time. We'll skip over the Cretaceous Tertiary, and we're now 92 million years. Here's the pattern of distribution. Now these are shallow water sediments in Colorado, Utah, on the Colorado Plateau and nearby parts of the Rocky Mountains. These are Cenomanian rocks down here, Turonian up here. This is the extinction at the end, or near the end of the Cenomanian. And again, what we see, these are big guys now, not little microscopic fossils. These are fossils you can hold in your hand. And this shows the gradual replacement across the boundary with a whole set of new species. And again, it seems that the species go out in a series of discrete steps. Now, what about the original? We can go back to the same column of rocks over here. Next slide, please. This was investigated by Carl Orth at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Orth, by the way, is now deceased. He was one of the real pioneers in very precise iridium and platinum analyses by neutron activation. And so here's what we see in the same column of rocks. Here's, and let's look at iridium. There's a pretty nice little peak here. Not a spectacular peak, but it's clearly a peak standing out. Another sharper one here. Each one of these peaks is at one of those extinction steps. Here's a peak in platinum. That's the same peak as down here. But you see that not all show the same ratio of platinum to iridium. There are peaks in the chromium, for example. Not everything lines up perfectly, but there are peaks in the noble metals in particular. And Orth has been able to trace these anomalies out of Colorado, down into Texas, and even into England. So we have, again, circumstantial evidence of impacts. I should tell you that Orth himself said, well, maybe something funny was happening in the ocean here, and this is not due to extraterrestrial material falling on the Earth, but something's happening to seawater. We do know that something was funny happening in seawater at that time. But my suspicion is that these discrete peaks really do reflect an extraterrestrial input. And again, it's associated with the distributed mass extinction, so we may then have an episode of a comet shower. Next slide, please. So how does our report card stack up? Well, here's the whole Phanerozoic geological column. It's a little bit out of date. Actually, this is from David Raup's book again, which is a little out of date now. We know the beginning of the Cambrian is back up here, not quite down here at 570, as thought earlier. Here, shown with the lines out here on the side, are events that could be called mass extinctions. The really big ones are shown with arrows, with tips on them. And here's the biggest one of all, at the end of the Permian. Some other really big ones, about five really good ones. KP boundary is one of them. There's a really good one in the Lake Devonian at the Franklin-Fenelon boundary. Another one at the end of the Ordovician. And then there are smaller mass extinctions that we just looked at. And their intensity is shown by different lengths of lines. And this is again a report there. Here's where we're at, more or less right now. Where you see stars is where there are iridium anomalies and or other evidence of impact, like spherules, shock quartz, along with them. Into the Triassic as multiple, very close space, shock quartz grains at the end of the Triassic in the Apennine Mountains of Italy. In the Lake Devonian, again, there are iridium anomalies that have been variously interpreted. They're very close to the time of the mass extinction. It's again been suggested, well, maybe the iridium has been concentrated biologically. But we do see a good sharp anomaly there, and actually, we have several localities now around the world that have impact spherules right in about this time. It might be we have again another comet shower this time. In fact, there's a second extinction that follows the Franklin-Fenelon that's pretty strong as well. So a lot was happening right in here. We don't know yet about, there are some suggestions that there are iridium anomalies at the end of the Permian. I'm not yet prepared to believe them. And we still have a long way to go. Or look long and hard for an anomaly here and it's not found. But my hunch is probably at least half of these mass extinctions will turn out to be associated with either a very big impact or a succession of close space impacts in time. So I think we're at a point where we say yes, impact has influenced the Earth, it's influenced the history of evolution, And of course, the big extinctions are just one side of the coin. Every one of these big extinctions, as many of you know, was followed by a burst of speciation. It created ecological space that was then rapidly filled by new species after the mass extinction. That's exactly what happened up here 65 million years ago. The large land-dwelling animals disappeared, the dinosaurs went out. There was a burst of speciation of mammals following that. And that, in the end, is really why we're here and why we're even talking about that. Thank you very much.